This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting St. Louis Public Radio. It's our first ever Friday News Roundup from the Show Me State. Anything much going on around here?
Good evening. Within the last 30 minutes, Governor Eric Greitens confirmed to News 4 that he did have an extramarital affair.
A News 4 investigation prompted this bombshell announcement from Governor Greitens and his wife.
It's hard to argue that the last 2 weeks were particularly positive for Governor Eric Greitens. His already wobbly attempt to stay in office was rocked by a bombshell House report on his conduct and another felony charge for computer data tampering.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The legal world is a busy one these days, especially in Missouri and Washington. The ongoing case, now cases, facing Governor Greitens is approaching something like an attorney's full employment program, even more so in Washington, where the president's legal bills also growing.
Well, that answers my question. But there are also lots of unanswered questions about the scandals, yes, scandals, plural, surrounding Missouri's Governor Eric Greitens, surrounding President Trump, and the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. So let's dive into it. Joining us today for the Friday News Roundup here at St. Louis Public Radio is its political reporter, Jason Rosenbaum. He was one of the voices you heard in our intro on Governor Greitens. Jason, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us here in St. Louis is Sarah Kendzior, a journalist and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The View from Flyover Country, Dispatches from the Forgotten America. Sarah, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And back home at our home base in Washington is Reed Wilson, a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, thanks for making time for us.
Hey, Joshua.
We begin in Washington, where former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani recently joined the White House legal team. It's been barely 2 weeks on the job, and he's already making some waves. During an interview with Sean Hannity on Fox News, Giuliani dropped a bombshell about a $130,000 payment made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels by Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen.
That money was not campaign money. Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation.
So they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Part of Rudy Giuliani's interview with Sean Hannity on Fox News. Now, the fact that the president not only knew about the Cohen payment, but actually paid Cohen back is a serious about-face for the White House. The president had told reporters he did not know about the payment. He also said he did not know how Mr. Cohen got the money for the payment in the first place. Giuliani's statement also contradicted Michael Cohen's claim that he had paid Daniels using his own money and had never been reimbursed. Cohen is currently under federal investigation. President Trump confirmed Rudy Giuliani's account during a string of three tweets yesterday. They read in part, quote, "These agreements are very common among celebrities and people of wealth. In this case, it is in full force and effect and will be used in arbitration for damages against Ms. Clifford, Stormy Daniels. The agreement was used to stop the false and extortionist accusations made by her about an affair," unquote. Reed Wilson, I wonder where we even begin with this, particularly, you know, just all of these dueling claims, what to believe. I'm not even sure where to start.
I want to go back through the transcripts of the last couple of months and see how many times you've had to say adult film star on air, because it's probably set some kind of new record.
You know, I think I've given up and just started saying porn star.
That's probably for the best.
Exactly. As opposed to, like, litigant.
Right. You know. The interesting thing about this is, you know, for a long time, the White House has said that, they have worried that Stormy Daniels represents a bigger threat to the president than the investigation run by special counsel Robert Mueller. And I think now we're getting a hint as to why. I mean, Rudy Giuliani sort of stepped in it when he said that this was not campaign money, that this was money funneled through a law firm. Federal law requires any office holder to list the obligations and debts that they owe for the previous year. President Trump offered no hint that he owed this debt and has since reimbursed it. By the way, they say this is not campaign debt. I would point out that there were reports earlier this week that that the Trump campaign is in fact paying the legal bills of Michael Cohen, or at least some of those legal bills. So there's a campaign finance element of jeopardy here. There's there are a bunch of issues as to whether or not the president has actually reported the things that he is required by law to report. So I think now we're getting a little hint as to why the White House is sort of quietly more concerned about Stormy Daniels than they are about Robert Mueller. And the fact is, it's not about an affair or any personal behavior. It's about things that could actually put him in more legal jeopardy than he already was.
Jason Rosenbaum, let me come to you with regards to Rudy Giuliani's comments. He claimed that he spoke to the president before and after that Fox News interview and that he wasn't just flying off the handle. What do you think about the strategy behind this? Is this Rudy Giuliani going rogue and saying something he shouldn't have said at a time he shouldn't have said it? Is this a more concerted part of the strategy? How do you read this?
It doesn't come off as very organized because, as you mentioned, you know, Trump was denying for a long time that he knew about this payment or had any part of it. So if it was suddenly an organized strategy for Rudy Giuliani to go on Sean Hannity and drop that aforementioned bombshell, that's some strategy. It doesn't really make a lot of logical sense, and it continues this perception that the president doesn't tell the truth about a lot of things. And I think that's a perception that has haunted him for his entire presidency and during his campaign. So if it was a concerted strategy, it's one I've never seen before.
By the way, I think either I or someone might have misspoken. Referring to Rudy Giuliani as a White House lawyer, he's on the president's personal legal team. I think I misspoke earlier in the hour. There are so many moving parts, it's hard to keep them all in mind. Sorry about that. So Stormy Daniels' attorney, Michael Avenatti, told CNN that he was, in his words, stunned and disgusted by Giuliani's comments. But he also said that they could be fuel for a money laundering case. Listen.
If they structured this repayment, this $130,000 repayment, if they structured it in a way to avoid detection or in an effort to make it appear to be something that it was not, namely a retainer payment as opposed to $130,000 reimbursement, that may involve money laundering depending on how it was handled.
Michael Avenatti speaking on CNN. Sarah Kensior, what about that? Could he be right? I mean, what does all of this mean for Stormy Daniels' case?
Yeah, I absolutely think Michael Avenatti is right. And I think, you know, Cohen is the weak link here. Cohen is implicated in a number of ways in this broader investigation into Trump's finances, Trump's Kremlin ties, all of these things. So I think when you start looking at Cohen, when you look at his sort of history as Trump's lawyer, and a Trump lawyer doesn't usually act as a lawyer. They're a fixer. They're a hitman. They're basically a goon. And this goes all the way back to Trump's days with Roy Cohn. If you look at that, if you consider what Mueller's team might have found when they raided Cohen's house. Cohen puts Trump in a very vulnerable position. And I think Stormy Daniels' case, while significant in itself, because, you know, she claims that she was threatened, is more of an entree into the broader crimes that have been committed by this campaign and by Trump and his team throughout his life.
Yeah, Reid, I did want to ask you about Michael Cohen's case. In addition to what Sarah just mentioned, there was also that report that NBC walked back about Michael Cohen's phones being wiretapped that turned out not to be a solid report. But what's your read on what this all means for Michael Cohen?
I think the report ended up being that Michael Cohen's phone calls have been monitored, which is different from actually being wiretapped.
Right.
Cohen is in some pretty serious legal jeopardy here. He faces a number of potential charges. He has not been charged with anything yet, although in one of his many appearances on CNN, Michael Avenatti, who you just played the clip of, said that he anticipates Cohen will be indicted in short order. The charges are separate, would be separate from Robert Mueller's investigation. Remember, Cohen is under investigation by the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of New York, which is independent of Mueller's investigation. So that hints that this is another person in Trump's orbit who faces some potential legal charges, not necessarily related to the president himself, but that puts further pressure on Cohen. And of course, we went through this. Was it this week or last week? All these weeks are blending together.
They blur together.
Trump insisted said that Cohen wouldn't flip, which, by the way, I keep going back to this comment that Congressman Trey Gowdy made a few weeks ago. He's the head of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. He said, you know, the president has to stop acting like he's guilty. And when the president talks about somebody who is definitely not going to flip, you don't flip unless there's something to flip about, right? And that sort of hints to me that this is a president who at least hasn't quite gotten Gowdy's message that, hey, maybe it's time to stop acting like you're guilty.
Adam, who's a loyal listener in St. Louis, asks, Trump paying money as hush money in order to not have the alleged affair brought up prior to the election, isn't that in itself covering up and attempting to circumvent campaign finance laws? Before we pause, Jason, is that the core possible crime, or is the way that it may have happened really the issue?
I think that's what people are looking at legally. From a political point of view, it's obscuring things from the public right before they had to vote in a very important election. And a lot of people in rural Missouri voted for Donald Trump, even with his moral lapses well known. I think if this had been known, he might have still won Missouri in the election, but it might have been a lot closer here.
Stephen tweeted, the most disturbing thing isn't that these powerful people are acting in ways that are corrupt and immoral. It is that so many Americans are willing to look the other way so that their political tribe can enact reactionary social and economic policies. Clearly, Sarah, we can tell where Stephen is coming from politically. But how do you see this playing out in Missouri? Do folks here care about all this, or are people in Washington really not paying attention to what folks in the Midwest really care about?
Folks do care about it, and people in Washington don't really care what people in the Midwest care about. I mean, that's just, you know, the story of the Midwest. And as for the comment that Stephen made about, you know, people being willing to overlook corruption on behalf of their tribe, Trump's tribe is billionaires and financiers and corrupt Republican, you know, members of the swamp. He likes to portray himself as somehow representative of states like Missouri, you know, that are poorer, that are more rural, where there's this sort of, you know, everyman connotation. He is not part of that. In terms of what I've heard from voters in Missouri, there's a general sense of disillusionment and frustration. There's, I think, a sense even among Trump voters that I've heard about the failure of the economy to improve. Statistics like the one you just cited of a low unemployment rate are really misleading because underemployment here is very bad. Wages here are very low. People who suffered in the 2008 recession, lost their homes, for example, still haven't gotten back on their feet. It's now been a solid decade. And so what you generally see is, you know, disillusionment. And there is, a group of hardcore Trump voters. I think no matter what he does, they're going to support him. They really don't want the Democrats to come in. It is partisan in that way. But overall, when I talk to people, I just see, frustration, disappointment, and a lot of the same problems they felt that they were experiencing under a different administration.
I definitely want to talk more about what's going on here in Missouri, particularly with its governor. But first, let's close the loop on what's been happening with the president this week, and then we'll move on to Missouri. President Trump's legal team played another round of musical chairs this week. The White House announced that Ty Cobb will retire at the end of the month and be replaced by Emmett Flood, a lawyer who formerly dealt with the Clinton impeachment. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said in a statement that Cobb had been planning to retire for several weeks. Reed Wilson, what do we know about what led to his decision and what this might mean for the strategy going forward?
Well, a few weeks ago, the president's legal team sat down with Robert Mueller and the rest of the special counsel team to talk about setting up an interview between the president and Robert Mueller in a formal setting. This is the interview that, you know, John Dowd, the former lawyer for the president, really didn't want to happen. When it became clear that the president did want this interview to happen, John Dowd ended up leaving. Ty Cobb has been the person who was the sort of the closest liaison between the White House and the special counsel's office. He was the one trying to provide as many documents as possible in hopes of getting this investigation wrapped up as soon as possible. He was the guy who promised that it would be over by last Thanksgiving, then by the end of the year, then within just a few weeks. And there is no sign that Robert Mueller is wrapping things up anytime soon. So Whether the president got frustrated with his with Cobb's continued insistence that this thing was over or not, it's not entirely clear. But this is a legal team that has been in more flux than I think most other legal teams of this high level ever would be. Bringing on Emmett Flood is actually something the president denied when the New York Times reported it about a month ago, and he said he was very happy with John Dowd and Ty Cobb and Jay Sekulow. Well, now only Jay Sekulow remains, and Emmett Flood is in fact coming on. So this tells me that the president's legal strategy is changing, and of course the number one strategist on that legal team remains the president himself.
Speaking of Robert Mueller, and the New York Times for that matter, the Times recently obtained and published, this week indeed, a list of questions that Mueller wants to ask the president in a one-on-one interview. Now, these questions fall into four broad categories, as the Times kind of curated them. Questions about Michael Flynn, questions about James Comey, questions about Jeff Sessions, and questions about possible collusion with Russia. Jason Rosenbaum, I wonder if there were any major questions that stood out or themes that stood out that might illuminate where Robert Mueller might be going or where the investigation stands. Did we learn anything from this list?
Well, when I read that New York Times article, it made me wonder if Mueller has collected evidence to possibly implicate the president or some of his key aides that would prompt him to ask those questions in the first place. I don't think Mueller would ask errant questions if there wasn't strong evidence to suggest that there was something amiss with either one, any one of those topics. So my feeling is that Mueller, if he gets to ask those questions to the president, is maybe trying to catch him in contradictions or try to, you know, find something that he has evidence with and try to catch the president in a lie, so to speak.
Sarah?
From what I had heard, it was not established that these were Mueller's questions, that Mueller's team had in fact been the ones that leaked it. From what I've heard, it was probably members of Trump's team, which would be a lot more consistent with previous reportings because the Mueller case has been pretty, you know, airtight. And in that regard, I think anyone following this case closely could have put together that list of questions. Those are the basic questions that anybody would want to know about this case that you could basically get out of news reports. And so the question is more, you know, who is the source? Why are they putting him out there? How are they trying to influence the case in the court of public opinion?
Indeed, some of those questions are questions that I think a number of news organizations have really been wanting to ask the president, but for the fact that he only kind of does interviews with the Fox News Channel these days. But a former Trump campaign aide, Michael Caputo, gave an interview to CNN this week on Wednesday. He talked about his own interview with the special counsel investigators, and he was quite candid. Listen.
The Mueller team knew more about what I did in 2016 than I knew myself. And I think they know more about the Trump campaign than anyone that ever worked there. These guys have got every single email, anything that's ever gone down, and they're clearly focused on trying to identify some Russian collusion.
So, can I just ask, how long were you there?
I was there 3 hours. I would compare it to a proctology appointment with a very large-handed doctor.
Okay.
It was an awful experience.
Well, if you weren't awake before, that was Trump campaign aide Michael Caputo speaking to CNN's Anderson Cooper. Reed Wilson, I hope you can be a little bit less descriptive in telling us what you think this means for the Mueller investigation. I don't know if you got this from the interview, but he looked spooked to me. He described the way that Congress is investigating as more like net fishing and the way that Mueller is investigating as spear fishing. It seems like he was almost trying to warn the president through CNN, these people are not screwing around.
Right. And I think a lot of the president's legal team has come to the same conclusion, which is interesting because the president still wants to do this interview. He thinks he can sort of talk his way out of any possible situation that Mueller might bring up. To clarify Sarah's point earlier, this list of questions actually was something compiled by the Trump legal team, by Jay Sekulow's team, after this sit down between John Dowd and Robert Mueller. They were the ones who came up with the list. It's not as if this is a leak that came out of the special counsel's office. At the end of the day, though, the thing that jumped out at me about all these questions was how much Robert Mueller is interested in President Trump's actual thoughts and the thought processes that went into everything from talking to James Comey about Michael Flynn. Well, you remember that old quote, "I hope you can see clear to letting this guy go. He's a good guy," to his decision to fire Comey a few months later. So this hints at the sort of jeopardy that the Trump legal team is most worried about, which is the fact that their client doesn't stick to the same story and is prone to sort of make things up. Just this week, we've heard a new twist, thanks to Rudy Giuliani, about why he ended up firing Jim Comey. Remember, President Trump told Lester Holt that he had the Russia investigation on his mind when he fired Comey. Later, he said it was because Comey had botched the Clinton email investigation, and Now we've got an entirely different explanation altogether. So this is clearly a special counsel who wants to know the president's thought process, and the president's thought process is not clear based on the president's own comments.
Well, and then beyond that, I mean, the back and forth between President Trump and Robert Mueller continues, as you mentioned, to keep boiling and boiling. This week, the president threatened to use the powers of the presidency to, quote, get involved in the Russia investigation. And then meanwhile, we learned that Mueller had threatened Trump's legal team with a grand jury subpoena back in March. Sarah, I wonder how seriously we should take the president's latest threats. I mean, does this mean that it's an overture to firing Mueller, getting involved in some other way? Is this just bluster? How do you see it?
It's not bluster. I mean, he's been involved in the Russian threat. He's been obstructing it from the moment he took office. He fired Comey. He did things like he refused to pass the sanctions, the Russian sanctions. When those sanctions were enacted, they weren't enforced. He met with Putin privately at the G20. He's set up back channels. He's done nothing to prosecute or even, maintain any kind of responsibility for other members of the administration who are hooked up with Russia in illicit ways. And so, Trump is an autocrat who is, trying to function in a democratic society and is willing to bend the law for his own use in order to escape the consequences of breaking the law. He will rewrite it.
Let's shift gears to Missouri and to a national scandal that is unfolding here. Governor Eric Greitens has been under investigation by the Missouri House Committee for alleged crimes of invasion of privacy. And this week, allegations of misuse of a charity donor list surfaced. Last night, Missouri lawmakers announced they have decided to hold a special session on May 18th to consider impeaching the governor. Jason Rosenbaum, how did we get to this point? Can you just summarize the charges that the governor's facing?
Oh, that's going to be hard.
I know. It's a list.
Because there's a lot.
Yeah.
There are two things that he's been charged with in court. One is the aforementioned invasion of privacy charge, where he's accused of taking a photo of the woman he had an affair with without her consent and placing it in a position to be electronically transmitted. He was charged with that in February. He goes on trial May 14th. The second felony charge happened a couple weeks ago, where he was charged by the same St. Louis prosecutor with obtaining a list from the Michigan News, which Eric Greitens helped found before he was elected office.
A nonprofit organization
to help veterans without that organization's permission, and then use that fundraising list to raise money for his 2016 campaign.
Worth noting that Eric Greitens is a Navy SEAL.
He is a Navy SEAL, a former Navy SEAL. He has mentioned that many, many times. So the second report, which came out this week, found shed light on when he obtained this list. Apparently, he obtained this list in 2014, right around the time he was transitioning out of the Mission Continues. And then it also has an email about when one of his staffers sent it to campaign aides, which then used the list to raise money from donors to that charity. It also has kind of an explosive revelation of a longtime aide to the governor, Austin Chambers, who's heavily connected to Nick Ayers, the vice president's chief of staff, basically trying to mislead another staffer into taking the fall for this. And Chambers has denied doing anything wrong. He has said that Nick Ayers did not know anything about signing this consent order. But, I mean, since Austin Chambers was Nick Ayers' eyes and ears on the ground in Missouri when Ayers was involved in Greitens' campaign in 2016, the question of how much he was involved is a reasonable one. And I think the White House is probably very nervous about what airs new.
Sarah, I wonder if by way of talking about Eric Greitens, contextualizing him for people who may not know him, we might get to a question from Samori, who tweeted, "I don't understand what happened with Greitens. I read his book, The Heart and the Fist, years ago and thought, this guy is awesome. Now he's an alleged criminal. How did this change occur?" I wonder, Sarah, if you could answer that. Also, by way of just explaining, like, who Eric Greitens was. I mean, he kind of came out of nowhere as this rising political star, and all of this seems to have occluded what for some looked like a pretty meteoric rise. How did this happen?
Well, Eric Greitens is a Navy SEAL who ties women to exercise equipment in his basement. But Eric Greitens started out as a Democrat. You know, he started out as kind of liberal.
That's part of the allegation with regards to this woman that,
yes,
whose picture he took.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to make sure I got that Navy SEAL in there. So, you know, he started out as this person who was kind of widely admired, thought to be pretty liberal, then switched to be a Republican, which is, you know, not unheard of in Missouri. Both governors, actually, in the last election had switched political parties. His opponent had as well. It's a kind of fluid thing. You know, he played up his military cred. He kind of tried to represent himself as a man of the people. There's a famous ad of him, you know, shooting a gun into an open field, portraying himself as an outsider, political outsider, which he never really was. And I don't think people really understood the depths of his corruption. I think he was generally thought of by many as a phony because he did this kind of 180 on an image change. But I don't think people realized, you know, the extent of the sexual assault allegations, corruption allegations, and how hooked up he was with certain figures in the GOP who are being scrutinized for their use of illicit campaign funding, among other allegations that Jason brought up.
Reid, I wonder if you could respond to this comment from Eric, who writes, "I hope you'll discuss why it matters that Governor Greitens had an affair and lied about it, when it does not seem to matter in the slightest that President Trump did exactly the same thing." Is there any kind of national resonance, politically speaking, from the Greitens case, Reid?
I keep thinking that if the president, if we had a normal White House and sort of a normal situation here in Washington, that something like Eric Greitens would be front page news in most major national newspapers. This is a guy who was lining up to run for president. I mean, he has already visited Iowa, ostensibly to campaign with Iowa's governor, but, you know, nobody goes to Iowa by accident, especially when they've got the first in the nation caucuses. His fall is truly remarkable in terms of the speed with which a rising star has now been pretty much politically snuffed out. The fascinating thing, too, is that he's in this big fight with Attorney General Josh Hawley, who's running for a U.S. Senate seat. So that's pretty remarkable, too. That's going to have impact on the midterm elections down the road.
Before we keep going, Sarah, I'd asked you earlier about how this is playing in Missouri. And you'd mentioned that there are a number of economic issues that also rise very high in the Midwest. I wonder if maybe that's a form of political cover is not the right term. But if the economy is really the core issue, then maybe the obfuscation and the sex scandals don't matter. Maybe people are either working and feeling good about the economy, or they're not working and they're more concerned about the economy than they are about presidential peccadilloes. Is that possible?
Well, I think if you look at people who voted for Trump in 2016, they were willing to overlook Trump saying that he grabbed women by the pussy. So honestly, a consensual relationship with a porn star kind of pales in comparison to that. You know, I think there are a number of factors that played into people's vote. But I guess one thing I want to emphasize is that most people, or a lot of people in Missouri, are suffering economically. People of different races and backgrounds. Only white people voted for Trump. I mean, that's true nationwide. And so I think that racial resentment played more of a factor in Trump's win than you know, economic anxiety, which is widely shared. And another thing to note is that about half the country didn't vote, and a good chunk of Missouri didn't vote either. So you just got people who are so disillusioned that they're not going to the ballot box at all.
And since you mentioned unemployment numbers and the economy as it relates to race, it's worth noting in the new unemployment numbers that came out today that African-American unemployment is still almost twice as high as unemployment for whites. Latino unemployment higher than for whites, but not as high as for blacks. Unemployment for women is down slightly, so women are slightly more employed in the market today than men. Let's make our way back to D.C. and the Environmental Protection Agency, where it's been another pretty chaotic week. EPA Chief Scott Pruitt is the target of a number of active investigations into ethics and spending issues. And in the middle of all these scandals, three of Scott Pruitt's top aides resigned this week. Reed, can you sum up what some of the allegations are against Pruitt and whether or not we have a sense of where they might be heading?
So there are at least 10 investigations into Pruitt and his time as director of the Environmental Protection Agency, or administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Some of them involve his spending on things like a soundproof phone booth in his office. Others involve his travel overseas. There are a lot. The Inspector General of the EPA is a very busy man right now. Pruitt himself has tried to, according to reports in just the last 24 hours, tried to expand his overseas travel. He basically came up with a list of countries he wanted to visit, talked to some of his top advisors and outside advocates to try to effectively make this happen. And then, of course, there's the investigation into his living arrangements. He lived in a condo owned by the wife of a big-time D.C. lobbyist who had business before the EPA. That scandal has already cost that lobbyist his job at his big D.C. lobbying firm. He's no longer with the firm, sort of speeding up his retirement. But Scott Pruitt was able to effectively crash at this very nice condo up on Capitol Hill for about $50 a night, only when he was in town. And that raises the question of whether or not that was a benefit that was only given to a government official, which is very much against the rules.
Is there any sense, Reed, of who might be succeeding these aides that have left? Who's going to fill these vacancies, or is that to be determined?
No, I think that's to be determined right now. The most fascinating thing that has come out in the last couple of days is that apparently the press office at the EPA was trying to shift a little bit of the focus away from Scott Pruitt, and I actually thought they'd done a pretty good job up until the last 24 or 48 hours. And by the way, trying to shift focus away by pointing out some other things that the Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, had done. It is not terribly normal for one member of an administration to be working behind the scenes with journalists to smear another member of the administration who, by the way, happens to be in the line of presidential succession.
Isn't Ryan Zinke Scott Pruitt's boss?
No, the EPA is a separate agency.
Thank you.
I don't think it's under Interior. I think it's a separate cabinet level agency, or at least it can be under some administrations. But the fact that one member of a president's cabinet is working underhandedly to undermine another is not something that we've seen a lot lately.
Jason?
Yeah, I think this speaks to a larger issue of Trump's administration. He's brought in people who clearly were not ready to manage huge federal agencies like the EPA. Pruitt was the Attorney General of Oklahoma, and I love Oklahoma. My great-grandparents are from there. I'm not trying to disparage that state. But going from a mid-level statewide official to being the leader of one of the most important federal agencies in the country, if not the world, is a huge shift. And I don't know what type of mores are appropriate in Oklahoma, but spending time at a condo owned by a lobbyist for an industry you're trying to regulate, certainly not kosher by any stretch of the imagination. And I think it's just a larger problem of the Trump administration that he didn't get people that were particularly ready to handle these important jobs.
Go ahead, Reed.
Yeah, if I can just jump in. I not to disagree with you, Jason, but I think Scott Pruitt was one of the more qualified nominees that the president chose. There are few people who understand the EPA better than Scott Pruitt. He knew all about the organization, and a lot of people can object to what he has done as the EPA administrator, but what has gotten him in trouble is not the fact that he was not qualified to do the job. It's his behavior on the job, including this the spending on a huge security detail or spending on overseas trips or things like that. Scott Pruitt was somebody who was qualified to do the job. He has just done it in a way that has raised all of these questions and therefore sparked all these investigations.
And just to tag on to the whole organizational chart point, Reed is right. The EPA is an independent agency of the U.S. government. Scott Pruitt, as the administrator, is not in the presidential line of succession as a member of the formal cabinet, but his position, administrator, is normally given a cabinet rank. So Reed is right on that. Sarah?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in here. I think what's going on is even worse than what both of y'all said. I think that people were intentionally selected for their cabinet positions due to their ability to dismantle the department. You know, you have a public education secretary secretary who doesn't support public education. You have a head of public housing who doesn't support public housing. And then you have an EPA head who doesn't support environmentalism, who is, you know, anti-climate change, anti-environmental regulations. And I think that that is intentional. You know, Trump said, you know, both during the campaign and before it, that he likes destruction, that he wants to dismantle the government. Bannon said that as well. And I think that's why Pruitt's there.
There's a strong case to be made for that, including among a number of the nation's governors, particularly because Scott Pruitt pushed some major policy changes that are kind of fueling President Trump's plan to overturn environmental legislation from the Obama administration. One of those changes was a revision of the emission standards for vehicles that would be sold in model years 2022 to 2025. 17 states, including California and the District of Columbia, have sued the Trump administration over the emission standards. Here is California's Governor Jerry Brown speaking about the joint lawsuit at a recent press conference.
This is a science-based attack that we make on these characters in Washington who, in the name of making America great, are making us weak and making the world more dangerous and unsafe. Because climate change is not a joke. The fires, the floods, the mudslides, the rising sea level, the disease vectors, the migrations, the turmoil that's going to come about, this is real stuff. And if Pruitt doesn't get it, and if Trump doesn't get it either, they got to go. And pending that, we're bringing this lawsuit, and I intend to fight this as hard as I can with all the resources at the command of California, joining with all these other 17 other states and the District of Columbia.
California Governor Jerry Brown speaking about the lawsuit at a press conference. Jason Rosenbaum, can you talk us through this a little bit, the significance of this lawsuit, the goal, how it might play out?
My understanding is California was allowed to have stricter emission standards based on the Clean Air Act. I think it was grandfathered in. And the Trump administration is trying, I believe, to roll back some Obama-era legislations, or not legislation, but regulations. And I would surmise that the majority of attorney generals that have signed on to this are probably Democratic attorney generals, similar to how a lot of Republican attorney generals attacked the Obama administration on a whole different host of issues. I think we're going to see this more often as long as Trump is president, is you're going to see Democratic attorney generals in Democratic-leaning states try to push back and fight back against what the Trump administration is doing on a whole host of fronts. I would not be surprised if you see a similar type of lawsuit against another agency, against other attempts to undo things that Democratic states like California have been doing for years.
And Reid, I don't want to linger on this for too much longer, but this has been kind of part of the post-Obama Trump era strategy from a number of Democratic governors and attorneys general. I think, you know, having moved here from California, Jerry Brown was kind of braced for this.
Yeah, and I mean, we're talking about the Attorney General of California, Javier Becerra, who has sued the Trump administration. I have actually lost count, but the last time I recall tallying it up, I think it was 26 times in just the 1 year that Javier Becerra has been on the job. There
are
you know, attorneys general from around the country who have made these lawsuits. You know, Sarah brought up this interesting point earlier that there is a big divide here between communities like St. Louis, which is one of the few big cities in America that's losing population, and states like California, where the economy is absolutely booming and the sort of the same issues are not under discussion. We've also got this political divide, too, where you've got an attorney general like Josh Hawley in Missouri, who under the Obama administration would have been suing left, right, and center. And now it's the attorney general of California, Washington, Oregon, Massachusetts, who are bringing all of these lawsuits.
A personal doctor of President Trump claims his office was raided last year by the president's former bodyguard and one of Trump's lawyers. Dr. Harold Bornstein told NBC News the raid came after he told reporters he had prescribed President Trump a hair growth medication.
What exactly were they looking for?
Well, his medical records, his pictures, anything they could find. We must have been here for 25 or 30 minutes. We created a lot of chaos.
Dr. Bornstein later told CNN the president had dictated his own health letter back in 2015. Jason, is this a thing? Where should we put this story in the context of everything else that's going on?
Oh, I don't even know where to start with that. Didn't the letter say that Trump was like the healthiest person in the history of mankind or something
like that?
Something like that. And I mean, I don't...
It was rather hyperbolic.
It was hyperbolic. And I don't think that... I don't know the president's exercise regimen or how healthy he actually is, But I remember that letter, and it did seem like Trump was dictating it. And it would not shock me if Trump's hair was facilitated by some artificial means, given that he's, what, 70, 71 years old, yeah. And it's blonde and...
Which is fine. Which, like, is if fine. That's what you want to do, whatever.
There's no crime against that, right. But it's sort of an image thing. And Trump is a very image-centric person, going back to the 1980s when he kind of came on the scene.
Let's move away from politics to wrap up the roundup with a story out of the city of Philadelphia. Two men who prompted Starbucks to reexamine its training policies have reached a settlement with the city. Their arrest at a Philadelphia store was caught on camera. It sparked days of protest over racial bias and an apology from Starbucks. The amount of the settlement... just $1. Rashawn Nelson and Dante Robinson decided not to pursue a suit. Instead, they wanted to try to create a positive experience. Philadelphia will also fund a $200,000 grant program to help high school students in the city achieve their dreams of becoming entrepreneurs. Sarah Kinzier, I kind of like this outcome, especially because if you've been to Philly lately, Philly is popping. There's a lot going on in Philadelphia with entrepreneurship, and a lot of young people of color seem to be quite locked out of it. This kind of seems like a happy ending.
It is. I mean, and I think, you know, this is an extraordinarily admirable act on these two men, you know, to support this and to be so, you know, gracious. And, you know, it also, as much as I think that's wonderful, I think we also need to not lose sight of why they got in this position, because this still continues to happen at other venues, this kind of racial discrimination, this kind of abuse by police forces. So I hope that people remember, you know, how this story came about, and while being grateful to them for the ultimate outcome.
Reed Wilson is the author of a new book called Epidemic. So, Reed, I'd be remiss if I let you go without just giving us a quick 30-second summary of what the CDC is saying about fleas, ticks, and mosquito-borne illnesses this summer. What's the latest with that?
So the CDC is really worried about this because the number of illnesses conveyed by mosquitoes, fleas, and ticks is on the rise, and it's rising dramatically. We've talked about things like Zika virus, which is transmitted by mosquitoes, Lyme disease, which is transmitted by ticks, and there are... not only are we seeing more infections from these bugs, we're also seeing more pathogens, more different viruses, things like Zika, which is new to the United States, chikungunya, which is a real bad disease down in your old neck of the woods in Miami and more sort of tropical parts of the country. So the CDC is really worried that there are more pathogens now, and they are more likely to infect people around the country. Basically, because the climate is changing, there are now more areas in which these infected bugs could actually get access to humans.
One last story before we let you go, ending on a business story. This week, the iconic American guitar maker Gibson filed for bankruptcy. The company is in debt perhaps by as much as $500 million, according to paperwork filed in Delaware on Tuesday. But don't despair, music fans. Gibson is planning a comeback. The company plans to liquidate its consumer electronic business and focus on making great guitars. And that is a great place to end the Friday News Roundup. We thank Sarah Kensior, a journalist and the author of The View from Flyover Country, Dispatches from the Forgotten America. Sarah, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Jason Rosenbaum is a political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, thank you.
Honored to be here.
And Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. His book is called Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Thanks, Reed.
Hey, thanks a lot, Joshua.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
We'd like to thank our sponsor who brings you this message, Discover Card, who alerts you if they find your Social Security number on any one of thousands of risky websites. Discover believes there are some things that you just need to know. It's just another way Discover looks out for you, not just your account. And best of all, Social Security alerts are free for Discover Card members. All you have to do is sign up online. Learn more at discover.com/freealerts. Limitations apply.
Hey, I'm Kelly McCavers from Embedded. Bill Spencer works at a coal mine in Kentucky. And when I start to ask him about a future without coal, he knows what I'm going to say.
So if
coal goes out, I'm done for.
Coal Stories on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
After 2 days of negotiations, a U.S. trade delegation returns from China with few details and no date for future talks. China says both sides realize there are some big differences between them and more work needs to be done. The Trump administration faces a deadline on re-upping the Iran nuclear deal. Iran warns the U.S. that it will not renegotiate a deal it has, quote, already implemented in good faith, unquote. And another bad week in Afghanistan. The president of Nigeria visits the White House, and also the Windrush controversy takes its political toll in the UK. We'll explain all those stories just ahead on the Friday News Roundup. We're in St. Louis, but back at our home base at WAMU in Washington, we're pleased to have David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. David, welcome back to 1A.
Hello.
Also glad to have Jennifer Williams, Deputy Foreign Editor of Vox and the co-host of the foreign affairs podcast Worldly. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And joining us here at St. Louis Public Radio is Kelly Kate Pease, a professor of international relations at Webster University in St. Louis. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's begin with talk of tariffs and trade. President Trump's top economic advisors are heading back from Beijing after talks to avert a possible trade war with China. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, and other senior economic officials met with Chinese officials to discuss trade disagreements. Here is Secretary Mnuchin speaking to Fox Business News before he left for China this week. The Treasury Secretary said at the time he was cautiously optimistic about the trip.
We're going to go over there. We're going to have very frank discussions. These are issues that President Trump has been focused on for over the last year, and hopefully we'll make significant progress. We're going there to make progress. That's our objective.
That was Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin speaking to Fox Business. Now, the U.S. wants China to import more American goods, and it wants Beijing to stop forcing American companies to hand over their intellectual property if and when they want to do business in China. David Rennie, what sense do we have of whether the U.S. delegation got any of what it wanted on this trip?
It seems to have ended pretty predictably with them agreeing they need to talk again. One of the problems we have, and there's many problems with this trip, is, you know, there are two reasons why the United States would send a plane load of its most senior officials. One is that they want to intimidate and show that they have a fantastically sensible plan, that it's been agreed by everyone, and this is a united show of force to send not just the Secretary of the Treasury, but also the Commerce Secretary, the U.S. Trade Representative, and also Peter Navarro, Donald Trump's top trade guy. The problem is that's not why they were all on the plane. They were all on the plane together because they disagree. And because they disagree and they distrust each other, they all wanted to be on the plane to keep an eye on each other. So the Chinese, one of their many complaints about the way that this is unfolding is they know that America is determined to get very, very tough on trade and wants some very big changes in that gigantic relationship between the two countries. But the first ask of the Chinese is, could you just agree among yourselves what you want? Because we don't yet know.
Jennifer Williams, if there is disagreement among the American delegation, I presume there was a little more cohesion among the Chinese delegation. What do we know about the people that the American delegation went to meet?
Right. So the benefit, I guess, if you want to call it that, of dealing with a rather authoritarian kind of cohesive regime is that they tend to all be on the same page when you go into negotiations. And that's part of the reason why, you know, like David said, it causes such a schism when the White House isn't really clear what they're even asking for, you know, what they can get concessions out of, what concessions they're even going to ask for. Whereas the Chinese go into this knowing exactly, here's what we're going to do, here's what we won't do, here's what we're willing to give on, here's what we're not willing to give on. And so when you have that kind of disconnect, there's the potential for China to end up completely basically running over the Americans entirely because they have no illusions about what they will and won't do and what they are going to ask for.
Professor Pease, I wonder what your read is on the way that this has gone so far. Granted, it's still kind of in the early goings. We do know about the different views, as David defined them, that are part of the U.S. delegation, including Peter Navarro, who we've spoken to on this program. He's never made any secret of the fact that he has really serious concerns about the Chinese and what they've done to undermine free trade. I wonder what you make of how that trip went and how it lays the groundwork for whatever's next.
Well, I don't think the trip went very well. The United States did not get anything precisely because it didn't know what it wanted. And China has had a tremendously successful development policy and it has used free trade to develop. And it's not going to change just because the United States comes in and says change. And so what the United States needs to do is work with its allies in a multilateral way to try to get China to change its behavior and to start behaving more as an advanced industrialized country rather than a developing country. And I think all of us who look at trade agree with the goal that we would like to stop forced technology transfers and that we would like China to stop engaging in espionage, corporate espionage. But at the same time, we need to work with our allies to do that.
I wonder what your take is, Professor, about the way that this conversation has gone under the Trump administration. I mean, I agree with you. I think that everybody kind of, at least in the U.S. and Western economies, wants to see the relationship with China change. I understand the argument about the lack of cohesion and the difficulty in getting things done. The supporters of President Trump would say that keeping our adversaries, and especially our enemies, on their toes is part of why we elected President Trump. That they don't need to know what the president's going to do. They just need to know the game has changed and you need to come correct when you deal with the United States. Is there something to that? Is it possible that that could shake loose some of the ossification in the U.S.-China relationship, or is it just setting up more trouble?
Well, it could, as long as we're not alienating our allies as well. I mean, we would like to see change, but we have to stop alienating people who are like-minded with us and would like to for China to change its behavior. And so what is happening is the United States just being disruptive, but without any strategy for moving China to behave better.
It should be worth noting that a Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman said yesterday, quote, the outcome should be mutually beneficial and win-win, unquote. And then, in a widely read commentary in China cited by the official Xinhua news agency, the message was pretty clear. If the talks did not work out and a trade war did break out, then China would never yield and would hit back strongly. Bishan Clark writes, trade talks with China are likely significant for what is not being said, with China holding the key to bringing North Korea to heel, and Trump desperate for a win on the Korean Peninsula and a Nobel Prize. What sort of concessions will the administration be making to China? David Rennie, what do you think?
So Donald Trump himself has linked trade talks and the fact that he was not going to get tough on China straight away as long as he was looking for their help on North Korea. That said, some of the things that he's been doing recently are pretty aggressive. China is still helping on North Korea. There is a sense that China's willingness to kind of see the North Korean crisis exactly the same way as Donald Trump may have peaked, that when Donald Trump announced to everyone's surprise, including China's surprise, that he was going to have a summit with the North Korean leader, you saw after basically putting relations in the deep freeze between China and North Korea, suddenly the North Korean leader, if you remember, caught his train to Beijing and was given a pretty warm welcome, a kind of red carpet welcome by the Chinese. And that was a kind of sign to many people who watched that dynamic that China's previous kind of close agreement with America that North Korea was a problem that needed intense pressure and very fierce sanctions enforcement, that perhaps they said, well, okay, if Kim is going to talk to Trump and Trump is suddenly willing to talk to Kim and he throws a sort of blindside like that, then maybe we're going to be closer to North Korea again. So that dynamic is in flux. On the trade side, the professor is absolutely right that people know that there is a need for this relationship to change. Plenty of allies around the world, in Europe, in Japan, they would like to have a big fight with China, but about some very specific things. The professor mentions the right ones, forced technology transfer, cyber espionage, industrial espionage. The problem with the Trump approach is that that's part of their plan, and you saw this big tariff plan that's linked exactly to forced technology transfer. But then they've done some other stuff that looks a lot more old-fashioned, a lot more retro, talking about steel, talking about cars. Donald Trump obsessed with the trade deficit, the need to attack China's trade deficit and to try and change that when most economists would tell you that that isn't really a measure of strength in a relationship and is affected by a whole bunch of other things. So Trump needs to pick one fight and stick to it.
Before we move on from this, Jennifer, I wonder what you think about the prospects for coming to a deal. It seems like the stakes are too high for the U.S. and for China to not come to a deal, right?
Right. The stakes are incredibly high. And, you know, China has made very specific threats. China could very strongly hurt the United States economy, and they're playing a political game. So they have threatened to put tariffs on very specific industries, in particular the soybean industry, which, you know, most people don't sit around thinking about. Yes, soybeans are a huge export, but it's a huge export for the U.S. economy. And if they were to put sanctions on it, it would be just disastrous.
Some of you are pessimistic about how this might turn out. Stuart wrote on our Facebook page, China is running the show now. They have alternative sources for agricultural products, and they hold potential markets that the U.S. and the West want to develop there. It's time for the West to suck it up, Buttercup. Professor Pease, is that true? I'm not sure I buy that. I think China has the benefit of size and scale. They don't have the benefit of intellectual property. That's why they keep taking intellectual property. I wonder how you see the power balance in terms of who has what leverage in the China-U.S. debate.
Well, in terms of the leverage, China's a growing economy. They are the future. They're the second largest economy in the world. And the key for them to transform from just being a middle-range power to being a advanced industrialized country is technology and technology transfer. And so they have a lot of leverage because, like the United States, they have a market. And our technology companies are willing to go to that market and provide that technology. And they don't seem to be all that concerned. I mean, they are concerned, but it is not as if they're going to move the jobs back to the United States if they're forced to hand over some technology or to work with a domestic partner. But the United States also has a tremendous amount of leverage, because we are the largest economy, and we are providing that technology, and we are the innovative arm. And the industrial policy of China, which is called Made in China 2025, is designed to help them become the leading technology innovators in the world.
Stroyant writes on our website, the1a.org, Trump's trade war with China is already causing inflation here in the USA, and it's not the benign kind of inflation that follows rising wages. Professor Pease, let me stick with you for a minute. How are folks, from your perspective, in this part of the country, viewing the U.S.-China debate? Do folks here in St. Louis and Missouri think much about China when it comes to thinking about their economic futures? Do you feel like the concerns are closer to home? Are there links in this part of the country that people maybe should be paying more attention to? How do you see it?
Well, I don't think the folks in St. Louis and in the Midwest see the deficit as that much of a problem. They don't deficit really doesn't affect them per se.
The U.S.-China trade deficit.
Right. And so in terms of manufacturing returning to St. Louis or into the Midwest, that's probably not going to happen in the high tech. Now, St. Louis is trying to position itself as a tech leader, but again, labor costs are tremendously high, and the Chinese economy not only has a young, highly educated workforce, and that's why the tech companies are going there. They can not only get highly skilled workers, but they can get it at a very inexpensive cost.
Before we move on from China, Jennifer Williams, how do you see it in terms of the impacts of this brewing potential trade war with China here on the U.S.? Are there impacts that you've noticed, or is this still kind of yet to flesh out?
You know, there have been fluctuations in the market kind of, you know, in response up and down to various statements both sides have made. But in general, it's sort of kind of a wait and see, kind of a holding pattern. But there's one thing that I feel like has kind of been undercovered. So tech companies are also starting to panic because of recent threats the Trump administration has made about limiting Chinese nationals from coming to work at U.S. tech companies, right? There are concerns that, you know, they may be a security risk in the sense of, you know, taking intellectual property and, you know, commercial espionage. But tech companies are starting to panic because they want those people to come and work for their companies, right? As the professor said, a highly educated workforce. So they're actually starting to push back and say, you know, no, you can't do this. You can't restrict it. We understand the security and intellectual property concerns, but also we need those workers.
A little more on trade and tariffs we should discuss. We found out on Monday that the Trump administration planned to delay a decision to impose steel and aluminum tariffs on the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. The delay lasts for another 30 days. Now, some see this move as giving key allies a little reprieve as the White House tries to cut some new deals with a range of key trading partners. David Rennie, President Trump has said in the past that he thought that a trade war would be, in his words, so easy to win. What does this delay mean in the scheme of things, particularly if it's the first delay of perhaps more delays?
It's gone down very badly with the European Union. The European Union is very clear that these steel and aluminium tariffs are, in their view, illegal. Remember that the way that the Americans decided to impose these tariffs was to say that it was a threat to national security. And that's like pushing a big kind of red button with a skull and crossbones on it in trade terms. Because if you say as a government that you're protecting your national security, you basically do an end run around all the normal rules that you have to prove that you've been hurt. You have to prove that countries are dumping steel and aluminium. It's like I get to do what I want because I've said this is national security. The Europeans, who are, remember, a very, very large economy, 500 million people, they're saying this is illegal, it's outrageous. And I've heard senior Europeans say to senior Americans this week in a private setting, we are not going to negotiate with a four-week deadline hanging over our head. You need to make a distinction between your friends and your foes. We are your friends. We are not just some country. We are 500 million people. And this is completely outrageous behavior. And I think the Europeans, remember, who have voters back home who are not in any sense keen on Donald Trump, don't want a trade fight with America, but they will have one if they have to. And this is really, really serious. And I think Americans are naturally very focused on China and North Korea and stuff. But actually, that old transatlantic tension with Europe could come roaring back if this isn't sorted out pretty soon.
Professor?
And the tariffs on Canada and Mexico are often seen as a way to leverage our NAFTA negotiations. And in terms of customs and norms regarding trade, you just don't do that. And so to sort of levy these tariffs and then to try to negotiate bilaterally just goes against the custom. And as David Rennie has said, is probably illegal.
Let's shift gear from trade to another big decision the Trump administration is coming up on a deadline to make. May 12th is the deadline to make a choice about the Iran nuclear deal, specifically whether or not to reimpose sanctions on Iran. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the National Security Advisor John Bolton both strongly opposed the nuclear deal, which was negotiated under President Obama. Jennifer, now that Pompeo and Bolton are in the Trump administration, how much chance is there that the president will leave the deal in place? I wonder if we're just kind of walking our way up to the inevitable reimposition of sanctions based on who the president has surrounded himself with and what the president has said.
Absolutely. Now, you know, predicting anything in this administration is a fool's errand. So
exactly,
he could do anything, right? Who knows? But it feels like the momentum toward pulling the U.S. out of the Iran deal has really started to speed up. And, you know, this past week we had this stunning moment where Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave this dramatic PowerPoint presentation, words that have never been said together before, by the way, unveiling, you know, this huge tranche of classified, you know, secret documents about the Iranian nuclear program. And it was very clearly geared to one person, and that is Donald Trump. And one of the slides literally just said, "Iran lied" in giant font, and that was the entire slide. And he then went on to Fox and Friends, which is not the typical place that powerful world leaders go to appear. But it was very clear that he was kind of pushing to have Trump pull out of the deal, right? And so now that you have Pompeo, now that you have John Bolton, as opposed to Rex Tillerson, who was kind of more the voice of moderation and maybe we should stay in the deal, the kind of controls as they, you know, as such, if we can call them that, that had maybe pushed Trump into staying into the deal a little bit longer, next 90 days, those voices are largely gone. Now you have Secretary of Defense James Mattis still in the White House, but well, in the Pentagon. But so he's also a voice of that. But essentially, Trump really, really, really wants to pull out of the deal. And it feels like he may actually eventually do this.
Let's talk about what the impacts might be if the Trump administration does pull out of the deal. David Rennie, Reuters is reporting that France, Britain, and Germany, in an attempt to save the deal, want to present the Trump administration with a separate political agreement that commits to taking a tougher stance on Iran. How do you read that, particularly in light of what might be at stake for the EU if Trump blows up the existing Iran deal?
So we need to unpack this. What is the Iran deal? It is a political agreement between the United States, France, Britain, Germany, China, Russia, the European Union, and the Iranians. It's not a deal that Donald Trump can blow up on his own. The problem for the others is that Donald Trump can reimpose American sanctions on Iran that would then hit European companies if they wanted to do business in Iran. So that's why the Europeans have a big stake in this. In theory, Donald Trump could reimpose American sanctions and say he's leaving the deal and the deal would carry on. You could imagine a scenario in which the Europeans say, we still think Iran is abiding by the terms of this deal. We don't want to blow up this deal. The deal carries on. But there, the problem for European companies is they have to choose, do they want to risk American sanctions for doing business in Iran? So that's a big problem. There's three things wrong with the deal from Donald Trump's perspective, and two of them the Europeans are willing to fix because they think that's reasonable. One is basically tougher inspections and verification. They think that's reasonable. They think they could do that. One is the deal never really tackled ballistic missiles. Again, the Europeans think you could do a side deal that tackles that. The third one is the hard one, which is Donald Trump says, I hate this deal because it starts to run out after 10 or 15 years. A whole bunch of restraints on the Iranians start to expire. I want this deal to last forever. The Europeans say, you can't legally just declare that. We could give you a political agreement that we agree among ourselves that it should last forever, and that's how we will behave in 10 or 15 years' time. But as long as the Iranians are abiding by the terms of the deal, you can't just tear it up. And Trump says basically, yes, you can. And the problem is, if he carries on down that line, his bet is either the others will just buckle and come to a better deal that he wants. They say legally they can't. And the fundamental difference here is when, as Jennifer said, the Israelis say you can't trust the Iranians, the Europeans go, well, we know. That's why we need this deal. And you sense that really what's animating the Israelis and some of the hardliners around Donald Trump is that they think there's no business doing a deal with Iran at all. The only sensible option is regime change. That's the logic of their total opposition to any deal.
Let's get to Iran's perspective on this deal. Yesterday, Iran's foreign minister Javad Zarif posted an English language video on YouTube outlining Iran's current position.
In the coming days, the United States will have to decide whether to finally abide by its obligations. Iran stands firm in the face of futile attempts at bullying. But if the U.S. continues to violate the agreement, or if it withdraws altogether, we will exercise our right to respond in a manner of our choosing. Bluster or threats won't get the U.S. a new deal.
That was Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif speaking in a YouTube video posted yesterday. Professor, that sounds a little bit ominous. We have the right to respond. I mean, what does that mean?
Iran has made a deal with the United States. It's trying to paint the United States as being unreliable and not fulfilling its obligations, and it's doing a pretty good job. There's a lot of sympathy for the position of Iran, but there's a lot of sympathy for the United States that Iran has been known in the past to cheat and to lie on agreements. And so what the ominous sound can be anything from stepping up its funding of insurgent activities in Iraq and in Syria, where we have an enormous amount of military presence. And they can also restart their nuclear program, and they could kick the inspectors, the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, out. And so we really don't know what will happen. You know, if the U.S. pulls out of the deal, we have to take some steps on our end, and whether or not we will actually do that is in question, and how others respond as well. But Iran is trying to communicate a very hard line. And I think it's because that when we come to negotiations regarding arms control, it's really not a good idea to link linkage is the common sort of strategy where you have agreement in one issue area linked to an agreement in another issue area. And this is why the Europeans want to do a side deal about the ballistic missiles, about the tougher inspections.
One of our frequent commenters, San B, wrote on our website, the1a.org, everything Bibi, Benjamin Netanyahu, said in his little show was already known. Interestingly, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis agrees with the Europeans that we should keep the deal regardless. Jennifer, I wonder what you think of that. It seems like some people looked at his presentation, as you said, and was like, yeah, we know. What about the overall impact of the presentation, including the fact that he gave the presentation primarily in English?
Right. That alone tells you a lot, right? So instead of initially delivering it in Hebrew, as he would normally do in pretty much every other speech, he started in English, right? And it was very, very clear, just even the visuals, like the actual slides and the props on stage, that it was meant to catch the eye of Donald Trump. It was meant to appeal to him, very simple language, very, you know, declarative statements. He at one point had a dramatic reveal where he rips off this curtain, revealing the stacks of folders, binders of documents. And then he rips off the curtain again. And there's this, you know, case full of, you know, thousands of CDs that have, you know, data and intelligence information, all these documents on them. It was very much just essentially theater. And the commenter is absolutely correct. There seems to be nothing substantively new that was at all revealed. There were public, you know, reports from the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which oversees the Iran nuclear agreement and making sure that Iran is in compliance. All of the information was from these reports. We knew all of this information already. The issue was more about trying to send a clear message. You cannot trust Iran. Iran lies, Iran cheats. So what the actual data and the information that they were revealing was that Iran didn't turn over, didn't reveal these documents they had about their secret nuclear program, right? So they still, even though they're maybe, you know, definitely, according to the IAEA, complying with the deal, back in the old days, they really did actually have a nuclear program, and also they haven't shredded those files.
Plenty more for us to discuss as we continue the Friday News Roundup with Jennifer Williams of Vox, Webster University Professor Kelly Kate Pease, and David Rennie of The Economist. Still to come, we should talk more about the State Department, including President Trump making his first remarks there since becoming president, and a follow-up on the story we've been following regarding the so-called Windrush generation in the UK. Stay close.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about the State Department. On Wednesday, President Trump made his first remarks there since becoming president a year and 3 months ago. He was there with the agency's new secretary, Mike Pompeo, who had visited the day before, not long after being confirmed for the role in a narrow Senate vote. David Rennie, what stood out to you about their visit to the State Department?
Well, clearly, everyone quoted the same line that Mike Pompeo has used a few times now, that he wants to bring the swagger back to the State Department. That the whole saga of the State Department under the Trump administration has been very strange, because actually the State Department, very briefly, was very excited when it got Rex Tillerson as the first Secretary of State. They saw this guy who'd been CEO of ExxonMobil, one of the world's largest companies, who looked like a real kind of power player. And they thought, wow, great, you know, this is going to be fantastic. State Department people, you know, if you talk to lots of Republicans in Washington, they think of the State Department as a kind of hotbed of Clinton voting, sort of hand-wringing, kind of foreigner-loving kind of weenies and liberals, and they sort of don't trust them. But actually, the truth is the State Department is full of patriotic Americans with very good educations who chose to go into the State Department and are very happy to work for Democrats or Republicans. You know, a friend of mine who works at the State Department said, the tragedy of Rex Tillerson failing to kind of co-opt them was, she said, we're very co-optable people. That's what we do. We work for any administration. And But Rex Tillerson kind of broke their hearts. He came in, you know, we don't need to rehearse the whole saga of his disastrous tenure there. So now they're trusting Mike Pompeo, though he is a hawkish former Republican congressman who, when he was a congressman, gave the State Department a very hard time when he was going after Benghazi and Hillary over Benghazi. But, you know, they applauded and cheered him because basically diplomats like to feel that they're connected to sources of power. So the fact that Mike Pompeo clearly has the trust of Donald Trump in a way that is not true of most members of the cabinet, the fact that he was able to bring Donald Trump for the very first time to the State Department for his swearing in, all of that has put a new spring in the step of this pretty unhappy bunch of people down at the State Department. So hope, you know, springs eternal at the State Department, and they are, you know, hoping that maybe this is a fresh start and a new start and they can get some stuff done.
Professor Pease, what about this idea of getting the State Department its swagger back? Is swagger what the State Department needs right now? And what do you think that even means?
Well, I definitely think the State Department needs its swagger back, but its swagger back in terms of being able to conduct diplomacy well. And diplomacy is a skill, and depending on how you think about it, Henry Kissinger likened diplomacy to a game of chess, and the late Ambassador Richard Holbrooke said, no, it's not like chess, it's more like playing jazz. Okay, but at the end of the day, regardless of how you conceptualize diplomacy, you have to know how to play chess, or you have to know how to play jazz. And so with the hollowing out of the career civil servants who actually do the legwork and the groundwork to the day-to-day diplomacy that the U.S. conducts our international relations, there is a morale problem. And so there is going to be some rebuilding that needs to be done. And it's going to be need to be done pretty soon, because if we pull out of the Iran nuclear deal, we have a big summit coming up. And summitry is like the Super Bowl of diplomacy. You have to lay a lot of groundwork and you have to have a lot of things prepared in advance. And the Trump administration hasn't really demonstrated it has a lot of expertise doing that.
Jennifer, before we move on from the State Department, when the president was there on Wednesday, he said, quote, "You'll be doing things that you don't even know about. Right now, they're not even a glimmer in your eye," unquote. Do you know what he was referring to? Was he referring to something specific, or was it a general kind of way to buck up the troops and say, we're going to take this place higher than it's ever been? What did he mean by that?
God only knows. Honestly, you know, with Donald Trump, he likes to riff. He likes to kind of, you know, throw things off the cuff. Sometimes there are hints that he's dropping that there may be, you know, new agreements or new things happening. And sometimes he's just saying words that he thinks sound nice. So there are going to be things that everyone does know, like the potential summit with Kim Jong-un. But I think, honestly, the most telling quote, and yes, everyone quoted the swagger comment, but I thought the most telling quote from the entire visit was Trump's first words out of the gate when he steps up to the podium. There are cheers and whistles. And he said, wow, I haven't seen spirit like this from the State Department in years, if not decades. He was both right and throwing Tillerson completely under the bus. But again, it goes back to, you know, I don't know if it needs its swagger back. I think first it needs its employees back. It just needs people. Maybe they can then develop some swagger. But you first need to just fill the empty job slots. And then you can actually do whatever twinkle in the eye things he's maybe hinting at or not.
Yeah, job slots that are empty both because they haven't been filled and also because the department's been cut quite a bit.
Right. You know, the number of new hires coming in, the fresh new crop, they're raising up the next generation who are going to go on to be the diplomats is dramatically down. And, you know, you can't blame them, right? It used to be if you want to be representing your country in the, you know, famous foreign service and see the world and go do the very real serious work of conducting American foreign policy abroad, you go to the State Department. It's an elite, you know, it's a job that people go to college to try to get. And now, you know, if they have no influence, if Donald Trump is doing his diplomacy himself, well, why would you want to go do something where you don't matter?
Jennifer, let me stick with you as we head back to talking about the Middle East, specifically Afghanistan. There were two bombings in Kabul on Monday that killed at least 25 people, including at least 10 journalists. It was the single deadliest attack involving journalists in Afghanistan since at least 2002. The Committee to Protect Journalists says it is one of the most lethal attacks involving journalists ever worldwide. Also this week, a U.S. soldier from Colorado was killed in Afghanistan. He was hit by gunfire. He or she was hit by gunfire in a district east of Kabul. Jen, what do we know about these attacks?
Well, so, you know, Afghanistan is essentially the war that is still going on that everyone has forgotten about, right? We are still fighting a very deadly, very bloody war in Afghanistan. The terrorist attacks, we happen to kind of pay attention to these this time because they were so horrific, and there were in particular journalists targeted. It seems they were targeted. It wasn't an accident. But these kinds of massive attacks have been going on in Afghanistan, and we kind of just don't notice anymore, right? Because we don't have the massive troop presence that we once did in Afghanistan. It's just kind of off the radar of most Americans. And even it seems the Trump administration, it's not really the foreign policy focus as it once was for previous administrations, which means, you know, there are still going to be American and Afghan casualties. We are still going to see horrific attacks. And it seems that we don't really have a strategy. The Trump administration is essentially kind of just doing the limping along, next 6 months are critical, right? It's an old kind of joke in foreign policy, a grim joke in foreign policy circles, that in Afghanistan, you know, the military is always saying the next 6 months are really critical. We're about to turn that corner.
Yeah.
And you turn the corner so much, we're spinning in circles, right? And the problem is that it just seems like no one even cares to try to get a strategy. You know, just recently, a Pentagon report came out that said we are not winning in Afghanistan. You know, a release like that, remember the Pentagon Papers, right? Papers saying that we were not winning the war in Vietnam and that the Pentagon knew that and yet kept sending Americans to die.
Yeah.
That ripped apart America, right? It was a massive scandal. And now it's just like, oh, I guess we're not winning in Afghanistan, but we're still sending Americans. Okay, next story. And it just, it's the forever war, and it's just never going to end.
Professor?
The other interesting aspect of this is that we don't really like to recognize that a lot of these attacks, particularly these stepped-up attacks, are being done by the Islamic State. We often think of the Taliban as the primary adversary in Afghanistan, whereas we see increased activity of Islamic State, and a lot of that has come from the military operation in Syria and in Iraq and has pushed these foreign fighters out to Afghanistan, push them into North Africa. And so there's consequences to our military operations elsewhere. And the problem I think the Trump administration is facing is there really isn't a military solution to this. There has to be a military solution as well as some sort of diplomatic solution as well.
A few more things to discuss before we wrap up. Let's head to the UK, where the so-called Windrush generation has dominated the headlines for the last few weeks. This is a huge debate over the status of thousands of immigrants, mostly from the Caribbean, who were invited to work in the UK, invited, between 1948 and 1971. Windrush was the ship that docked in England back in 48 with workers from Jamaica and other islands in response to labor shortages after World War II. David Rennie, quite a bit has happened since we discussed this last. The Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, resigned because of the scandal. Sajid Javid, the new Home Secretary, is the son of Pakistani immigrants. He's the first non-white politician to hold one of these most senior British cabinet positions. What does this mean in the UK right now, particularly with these changes at the top with the Home Secretary?
I think what you need to know is that the British public, having told politicians for some time that they wanted a tougher get tough immigration policy, when they see what a get tough immigration policy looks like on the ground, they don't always like it. And, you know, the current Prime Minister, who used to be Home Secretary, she kind of made her political reputation by being extremely harsh in her rhetoric about immigration and saying that the problem was that Britain was much too tolerant of people who were living without the right papers, that it was time to get really tough. She talked about creating a very hostile environment. And part of that was that if you couldn't prove with every last possible piece of paper that you had the right to be there, the assumption was that you didn't. and you were deported as quickly as you could. A whole bunch of these people, as you say, who were invited in, or their parents were invited into the country as guest workers from the former British Empire, if they didn't have every last piece of paper, and some of them didn't for perfectly reasonable, you know, explanations, they were in some cases threatened with deportation, though they had every legal right to be there. That behaviour, really shabby behaviour to retired London bus drivers and retired kind of Midlands nurses, has really shocked the British public. And it turns out that they're not quite as willing to have this very, very harsh immigration policy as they maybe thought they were.
In January, the press reported that President Trump disparaged African nations in very vulgar terms during an Oval Office rant about immigration policy that was met by alarm and outrage by leaders in Africa. But when President Trump met this week with the first sub-Saharan African leader to visit him at the White House, apparently it didn't come up. In a joint press conference, a reporter asked Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari about this.
Did you address his reported comments from earlier this year when he reportedly used vulgar language to describe African nations?
Well, I'm very careful with what the press says about others and myself. I'm not sure about, the validity or whether that allegation against the president was true or not. So the best thing for me is to keep quiet.
We didn't discuss it, and you do have some countries that are in very bad shape and very tough places to live in, but we didn't discuss it because the president knows me, and he knows where I'm coming from, and I appreciate that.
Part of a joint press conference with President Trump and Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari. Professor, what do you make of this?
That's diplomacy. Nigeria and the United States have a lot of shared interests, particularly as it relates to counterterrorism activity, attacks on Christians, economic and development aid. And so you have to put aside these things, find out where you have shared interests, and move forward.
One more story that we would love to get to before our time is up. For those with good memories, you'll recall last week we did a story about Sweden. It seems to be becoming a pattern now, so let's keep going with it. Swedish meatballs, popularized around the world by their association with the Scandinavian furniture giant IKEA. Turns out, they might not be Swedish after all. In a shocking declaration, Sweden's official Twitter account has suggested that Swedish meatballs may have actually originated in Turkey. Quote, Swedish meatballs are actually based on a recipe King Charles XII brought home from Turkey in the early 18th century. Let's stick to the facts. Unquote. Professor, is there nothing I can trust in this world anymore? Not even IKEA meatballs, really?
Really? Well, it just shows globalization's been around for a long time and is likely to continue.
You know, I would like to be able to just try, well, you know. Professor Kelly Kate Pease of Webster University in St. Louis, thanks for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Williams, deputy foreign editor of Vox and the co-host of the podcast Worldly. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And David Rennie, Washington bureau chief of The Economist. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. We're back in D.C. Monday. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. This is 1A.